Doesn't it? Yeah, that those lights. That light, just the one light. I don't know. Oh, thank you. Good weekend? No. Just a weekend? But now it's Monday, which is great, right? Okay, good. So, Quinn, did you do a version of the turnstile?
Over the weekend, I was helping my parents plan their move across the country.
Oh, that.
So I'm still working on it.
Okay, all right. No, just if you do it and if you want to read it.
I'm excited to do it. Okay. Maybe less excited to read it, but I'm excited to do it.
Okay. All right, well, let us know when, if, no rush. Sorry?
I have a plan.
You have a plan. Okay, good. Does anyone know Jenny? No, Jenny in this class.
Oh, no.
No. Okay, she's Jenny Sampson. She, here I got some handouts. One of them you already have, but now there's more. But here is 10 lines from Aurora Lee, book 5. Maybe you'd prefer 5 lines from book 10. But just to continue a little bit what we were talking about last week. So this is Aurora reflecting on poetry. Then we'll go back to the Browning poem we were looking at. And then to the, not the EBB, but the RB poem, the Robert Browning poem we were looking at, development. Thank you. And then some more Robert Browning. Okay, so this is part of a long reflection about what poetry should be in the mid-19th century. So I'll just read it. Nay, if there's room for poets in the world, and remember that she is the feminist poet in a modern world. Nay, if there's room for poets in the world a little overgrown, I think there is. Their sole work is to represent the age, their age, not Charlemagne's, this live, throbbing age that brawls, cheats, maddens, calculates, aspires, and spends more passion, more heroic heat betwixt the mirrors of its drawing rooms than Roland with his knights at Roncesvalles to flinch from modern varnish, coat, or flounce, cry out for togas, and the picturesque is fatal. Foolish, too. King Arthur's self was commonplace to Lady Guinevere, and Camelot to minstrels seemed as flat as Regent Street to poets. So, what would a one-line paraphrase of that be? Yeah.
It's a poet's job to be more reflective of their own age instead of trying to harken back to ages of old.
Right, yeah. So, just write about modern varnish, modern coats, modern flounces, modern dress, basically. Write about this industrial age, an age of brawls, cheats, calculations, aspirations. Write about contemporary drawing rooms. Don't write about Arthur and Guinevere and Lancelot. Like whom? Who does write about Arthur and Guinevere and Lancelot, whom we've read?
Tennyson.
Yeah. We read The Mort d'Arthur, The Death of Arthur. We, you know that he wrote this poem that it ended up being a book-length poem called Idylls of the King, which is all Arthurian stories. We talked about why Arthur, partly because it's Hallam, Arthur Hallam. But Tennyson is very much, has very much an idea of poetry as kind of sinking into an eerie, absolute, haunting otherworldliness. And you could say something like the Lotus Eaters, that's what that's about. The melancholy Lotus Eater song, that is what Tennyson wants to be writing. Poetry is an escape from the modern world, a sort of sinking into a half dream, half life. And Tennyson is ambivalent about that. He's aware of what he's doing. It's not that he is simply nostalgic. He's not doing, he's not a kind of, I don't know if this is fair to him, but it might be a kind of George R.R. Martin of the 19th century. I mean, I don't know if it's fair to George R.R. Martin. He is interested in the psychology of being drawn into this otherness, away from this world of geology and survival of the fittest and violence and death. But of course, he writes about that. We didn't talk about the Charge of the Light Brigade, although I mentioned it, and it's in the book. But the Charge of the Light Brigade is about the Crimean War, which is going on when he writes it. In fact, the poem had an effect on English enthusiasm for the war and English patriotism and their sense of, look how noble the Light Brigade was in going against impossible odds. Stormed at with shot and shell, boldly they fought and well. So it's not as though Tennyson is someone who ought to be caricatured this way. But maybe what you could say is that some of the pleasure that some of his readers take in his poetry is something that EBB and Aurora Leigh are complaining about. That's not what you should go to poetry for. It shouldn't be, let's just say, the higher escapism. Escapism into a fantasy world, which is just so beautifully done, which it is in Tennyson, but that's so beautifully done that you don't have to face our world, the real world. As I say, Tennyson, and we talked about this a little bit, but Tennyson in his book-length narrative, The Princess, of which we saw a couple of poems that are excerpted, the narrator, the main character of The Princess, is someone who does have this tendency to fall into melancholy half-dreams. And it's a problem for him, but it's a good thing for the poet who can describe those melancholy half dreams. But here EBB is here. She's saying no. Or Aurora Leigh is saying no, write about the present. Write about the same stuff that Dickens writes about. Write about the same stuff that George Eliot writes about. Write about what the novelists, what contemporary novelists are writing about. So I just wanted to give you one more sense of that before going back to the poem development that we still have the last stanza to look at. So there's a lot of Robert Browning we have left to do, and it's not clear how much we're going to get done this week, so we may spend a little while after break on him. But if you just look now at that last stanza, remember what happens is, here it is, modern times, and modern scholarship has destroyed the dream of Homer that he grew up with. So a thing to notice is that, so do people know the saying, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny? Is this a, it turns out not to be true, so I think that people don't, it's no longer something that people learn when young. But it used to be believed, tell me if you ever heard this, that if you looked at fetal development, what you would see is a fetus has gills, then it loses its gills. You've heard that.
I've heard about like the vestigial tail.
Yeah, and then the tail gets sucked into the coccyx, and there used to be a theory in biology which is that if you look at a fetus developing, you are seeing the history of human evolution. That is, that you are watching as the fetus gets gills, loses its gills, has a tail, loses its tail, eventually comes out as a human. But then it goes through all the stages of evolution, concluding with a human being. So that turns out not to be true, and but it was a really attractive theory up, I think, until maybe the 1970s or something is when people said, no, this is BS. But the three word summary of this theory is ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, which is to say the development of the individual recapitulates the development of the species, or in this case, the development of the phylum, let's say. And there's a sense in which Browning is thinking, Robert Browning, I'm going to call him Browning, and I'm going to call EBB EBB, because that's how they refer to themselves and how the public did. Browning is sort of describing the same thing as many poets do, going all the way back to the Book of Genesis, which is, well, let me quote a great line from Emerson. What is the face that the world shows every aspiring spirit? Strange to say, the fall of man. And what he means by that is that every person undergoes that fall. That is, that what is a theological history of humanity, which starts with the fall of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, is also an individual history for every human being. So that's ontogeny recapitulating phylogeny. For Browning, for many of the Romantic poets, the idea is something like if you have nostalgia for the ancient past, that is of the sort that Aurora Leigh is here strongly against. It's also nostalgia for your own childhood. That is, there are two ancient pasts in a person's life. Their own childhood, their own oldest memories that adulthood has displaced and brought us into modern times. And the idea that human history also, or at least human literature, human myth, human poetry, also goes through the same development. So it used to be that humans believed in these wonderful stories about the gods, but now we're moderns, and we know that information technology is constantly keeping watch over us, or something like that. So there's an idea of human history, an idea of individual history that parallel each other. So that's ontogeny recapitulating phylogeny. So in a sense, that's what Browning is describing here. He's saying 3,000 years ago, there was Homer, and he was telling these amazing stories. And 73 years ago, there was me learning these amazing stories. And then what happens over 3,000 years is we discover, scholarship discovers, that there was no Homer. And I discover that there was no Homer. So the same thing happens. And here in giving an account of his own development, and that word can refer both to social and individual development, to ontogeny and to phylogeny. That development is one that the poem is describing in personal terms, but what he learns personally is what scholarship has discovered. So there's a kind of beginning at the same place, which is Homer is telling these amazing stories, and an ending at the same place, which is there was no Homer and these stories are not based on anything real. But in the meantime, he is in his own life learning Homer, loving Homer, etc. But then Wolf comes, and why must he needs come doubting, spoil a dream? But that's what he does. He comes doubting and he spoils a dream. And then I'll just read the last stanza. But then no dreams worth waking, Browning says. So who is he referring to with that word Browning?
His wife.
So he would probably call her EBB. So I think it's as though he's standing outside of himself and quoting something that the speaker of the poet is not quite the author of the poem. It's also a little bit funny. So no dreams worth waking. What do you think that means? No dreams worth waking. I think it's an ambiguous line. What are the possibilities? What part of speech is waking?
Is there like a gerund here?
What'd you say?
Verb.
A verb. Transitive or intransitive? Do you know the difference? Do people know that terminology, transitive and intransitive?
It's more of a transitive verb, right? You wake somebody.
Yeah. So you can also just wake, which is intransitive. So some verbs always have direct objects. It would be really weird to say I hit, but not at all weird to say I hit the ground running. So if you say, I hit the ground running, it's got a direct object, the ground, and that makes it a transitive verb. It's a verb with a direct object. An intransitive verb is a verb that never takes a direct object. So it's hard to find pure intransitive verbs offhand, though there are plenty of them. Can anyone think of them?
Rise.
I rise. That's right. You don't say, I rise the dough because I'm yeast. You say, I make the dough rise. But rise, good. Rise does not take a direct object. And then there are lots of verbs that are both transitive and intransitive. They sometimes take direct objects and they sometimes don't. So I see is intransitive. I see the clock, and boy, is it moving slowly, is transitive. I'm not sure about that laugh. The question here is, does waking have a direct object or not in those four words? So you're nodding, Sam.
Yeah, I feel like the dream is what it's acting on.
Okay, so it's not worth it to wake any dream, which would mean something like to end any dream. It's no dream is worth interrupting, let's say. What if it's a gerund? That is, it's a verb being used as a noun, like sleeping is fun. So when you say sleeping is fun, you're using sleeping as a noun. So what if it's being used as a noun? Then what would the line mean? Yeah.
It's not worth having a dream if you're going to wake up.
Okay, so no dream's worth the act of waking?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Or it could mean something like no dream's worth waking life. That is, waking could be just a one-word abbreviation of waking life, of being awake, of the state of being awake. So no dream's worth waking. This is all a dream. Now we know the truth. The truth is what's important, not the dream. So it can go both ways, and that may express something like his ambivalence about it. So, but then no dream's worth waking, Browning says. But what does he mean by it? We don't know. And here's the reason why I tell thus much. I, now mature man, you anticipate, may blame my father justifiably for letting me dream out my nonage thus. So I can be angry at my father for letting me just dream all this time and believe there was Homer and believe there was Achilles and believe there was Priam and Hector. And only by such slow and sure degrees permitting me to sift the grain from chaff. Only slowly did I figure out what was true, the grain, not the chaff. Get truth and falsehood known and named as such. Why did he ever let me dream at all? Not bid me taste the story in its strength. So why didn't he tell the truth to me when I was a little kid? Suppose my childhood was scarce qualified to rightly understand mythology. So what would it mean to rightly understand mythology? What might you major in if you wanted to rightly understand mythology? Not that many choices.
The classics?
Yeah, probably not. Probably anthropology. If you major in the classics, you're going to be looking at the myths as, wow, great stories. It's so sad what happens to Thamyris, whom we're about to turn to. It's so sad to happen and what happens to Patroclus. But if you take anthropology, it's going to be, yes, this is a myth about the clash of cultures, in which you have the representation of the new versus the old, or something like that. Or it's an agricultural myth. That is, that the destruction of Troy was the was a way of describing the attempt to replace the agricultural dominance that is beginning to displace a hunting, gathering, herding society, which is why you get walled cities to begin with. So this is a myth about agriculture, let's say, versus hunting or versus shepherding. So that is, that could be what it would mean to get truth and falsehood known and named as such. My childhood was scarce qualified to rightly understand mythology, fine. Well, silence at least was in his power to keep. I might have somehow, correspondingly, well, who knows by what method, gained my gains, been taught by forthrights, not meanderings. My aim should be to loathe, like Peleus' son, a lie as hell's gate. Love my wedded wife like Hector and go on with all the rest. So this story didn't teach me to lead a rational life. But notice that the metaphors for leading a rational life are coming from the story. So here is a kind of an amazing mode of reverse meta-ness, which is, my aim should be to loathe like Peleus' son. Do people know who Peleus' son is in the Iliad? Achilles. So my aim should be to loathe like Peleus' son, a lie as hell's gate. So I should have hated lies just the way Achilles did, which is to say I should have hated the story of Achilles, which was a lie. So the story itself is where he goes to describe what his attitude towards the story should be. Love my wedded wife like Hector, and so on with all the rest. Could not I have excogitated this without believing such men really were? Did I have to really believe in this story? That is, he might have put into my hand, so who's the he there? His father might have put into my hand the ethics. Anyone have any guess what ethics that is that he's talking about?
Plato?
No. Good guess. A student of Plato's.
Aristotle's
book, The Nicomachean Ethics. So he might have put into my hand the ethics. In translation, if you please. Exact. No pretty lying that improves to suit the modern taste. No more, no less, the ethics. So Aristotle was very famous as an empirical scientist who did everything by observing the empirical world, the opposite of Plato. And therefore, in a sense, the opposite of Homer. "'Tis a treatise I find hard to read right now that my hair is gray, so I should have been reading it as a kid. And I can manage the original, because he can read Greek now, so I can manage the original. At 5 years old, how ill had fared its leaves." If I tried to read the ethics when I was five, I would have totally screwed the book up. Now, growing double or the stagger right, do people know what that word means, the stagger right? It's a name for Aristotle. He's always called the stagger right. Now, growing double or the stagger right, at least I soil no page with bread and milk, nor crumple dog's ear and deface boy's way. So I should have read this younger, but at least I am not leaving the book in bad shape the way I would have as a boy, the way boys read stuff, boy's way. So obviously there's irony at the end of that. He's describing the loss that truth brings to the world, brings to human experience. And he's reading Aristotle, he's an old man, and he's not doing all these childish things, but truth costs a lot and isn't worth the cost, I think is the suggestion in this poem. So it's the same issue. It's not that he and EBB are on opposing sides of things. She wrote plenty about mythology. He wrote plenty about the modern world, including in this poem. But it's the same issue, the relationship of what can be accused of being nostalgia and falsehood and fantasy in poetry versus the truth of modernity, of modern scholarship, of modern science, of modern analysis, and how we deal with those things. Last class I gave you a couple of pages from Browning's last poem, Aristophanes' Apology. I thought I'd give you a little bit more context for that. So this, the sheet that's coming around now, it's a single sheet, has what I gave out last time reduced on one side, labeled 3 and 4. And but first, I want to give you a little bit of context for that, because we're going to look at a late Browning poem that's part of this late Browning, extremely long poem. But there's a poem within the poem that we're going to look at. So on the first side of the page, where it says 1, there, what you have there is, because Browning was in development, was talking about Pope's translation of the Iliad, I'm giving you Pope's translation of the relevant passage in the Iliad. How many people have ever read the Iliad? Okay, yeah. So you should. It's utterly amazing. And one of the things, if you've ever read Paradise Lost, you know there's a catalog of fallen angels in Paradise Lost. And that comes out of the Iliad, where Homer gives a catalog of ships. And the catalog of ships is all the Achaean ships, all the Greek ships, essentially, that came to fight against Troy. And it's basically a list of everyone. It's like the credits at the end of the movie. If you were an extra in a movie and you get to see your name in the credits, no one else is going to notice, but you're going to be happy and you're going to be proud and show your friends and find yourself on IMDb. So same sort of thing happens in the Iliad, which is there's a long catalog of all the different cities and states and cultures and islands and everything that sent a ship to fight against Troy. And Homer is describing one such place, Pylos, that sent 90 ships and all the towns in Pylos. And then he says something really interesting about the Thracian poet Thamyris, who is a mythological character and who believed that he could compete with the muses as a poet. So he's a mortal person. His is the first story in Greek mythology of same-sex passion. And he uses, this is not the Iliad, but it's part of his story. But he's immortal, but he competes with the muses. And so, let's see, where do we get to last time? Matt, did you read last class when we did development?
I believe I read.
Yeah. Okay, so fine. Why don't you read those 8 lines or whatever they are, 10 lines.
Okay. And Dorian famed for Themeris' disgrace, superior once of all the tuneful race, till vain of mortals empty praise he strove to match the seed of cloud compelling Jove, too daring bard, whose unsuccessful pride the immortal muses in their art defied. The avenging muses of the light of day deprived his eyes and snatched his voice away. No more his heavenly voice was heard to sing in his hand. No more awaked the silver string.
Great, thank you. So this is all that the Iliad says about Thamyris. It actually says one more thing, which Pope doesn't translate, which is that the muses destroyed his memory, and you can't be a poet without memory. But here is this poet who defies the muses as a poet. And the muses, he has a singing contest with the muses. That's the myth. And then the muses, after he loses, because you're not going to beat the muses in a singing contest, after he loses, his memory is destroyed. So Sophocles wrote a play called Thamyris, and I just gave you the surviving fragments of that play. This is what Browning knew, and what we know about the surviving fragments of Thamyris. The fragments survive because other ancient writers quote them. Plato will say, or someone else will say, well, for example, Herodian will say, here's a good line that shows you how poetic meter works. That's number 237. And he quotes the line. Or Athenaeus quotes something else in another text. So they're just little tiny, tiny fragments of this play that survive, but the play does not survive. Sophocles, you'll recall, wrote Oedipus. So he wrote a play called Thamyris. The play does not survive. Moment, though, look at fragment 245, which I think Browning must have really liked. So this is, Plutarch quotes this. And I was seized by an urge to be mad for music and went to the place of assembly, an urge inspired by the lyre and by the measures with which Thamyris makes music supremely. So probably that's the chorus singing. And they're so amazed by Thamyris that they just want to dance with him, to be made mad by music. So this is what Browning would have known about this lost play, just these fragments. And then in this late, late poem called... The late poem is called Balaustion's Last Adventure, and there's a part of it called Aristophanes' Apology. And I mentioned this, but I'll just remind you of what we were talking about on Wednesday. So Aristophanes' Apology is Aristophanes is the comic poet, and he is talking to Balaustion, who is the narrator of this poem. And he is basically... maybe you could say he's a modern. That is, he doesn't think poetry should be all about myth. And, you know, he might take the same stand that both EBB and Browning are thinking about or considering. But he then describes in a debate with Balaustion, who likes older poetry and likes mythology, he then says, well, you know, there was this fantastic play by Sophocles, Thamyris. And even though I make fun of Sophocles, I have to say that he was pretty amazing. So you can read a little bit of the intro at the top of that column. Our Sophocles, youth, beauty, dedicate to Thamyris, who named the tragedy. The voice of him was weak. It's one of the strange things with Sophocles, probably played Thamyris. Sophocles almost never appeared on stage, but as a young man, he might have appeared in his own play as Thamyris and wasn't very good, which is why he was not an actor. So anyhow, I don't know if you need to know any of this context, but it's on Browning's mind somewhere. But then Aristophanes says, just before the arrow, but lend me the psalterion, nay, for once let my hand fall where the others lay. I see it just as I were Sophocles, that sunrise and combustion of the east. So it's sunrise. And then we get the introduction, and then he sang. Are these unlike the words? And now we get this poem about Thamyris. And its first two words can serve as a title for it, Thamyris Marching. And the context of the poem is that Thamyris is off marching to the contest with the Muses. So this is before that contest. He's on his way to compete with the Muses. We know what will happen, but he doesn't. But that's not an irony. That's a strength that he has, that we know what's going to happen, but he is in the dawn. It's the dawn of the day. It's the sunrise and combustion of the east, and it's his own sense of his power as a poet. And I guess it's a little bit hard to say how much you can read, but let's do it sentence by sentence. So, Irina, do you want to start with Thamyris Marching?
Sure. Thamyris Marching, lyre and song of thrice. Perpend the first, the worst of woes that were allotted lyre and song, yet poet race.
Keep going. Okay.
Thamyris from
Oikalia.
Oikalia, beast of there, by kingly Eurotas of late, now bound for Dorian at the upside, brought and there. Of Mount Pangaeus, or with earth and loud, glittered beneath his footstep, marching gay. And glad Thessalia, though, came robed and crowned, from triumph unto triumph, mid array of early morn, came, saw, and knew the spot, assigned him for the worst of woes that day.
You can stop there. Okay. So lots of it's worth unpacking. What do you notice about the rhyme scheme? So start with Thamyris Marching.
It's that sort of interlocking rhyme scheme.
So how
been talking about that?
Yeah, so how does the interlocking work?
If you bound, bare, and wound. Yeah, I don't know. It's we've got these three-line stanzas.
Okay, so first of all, three-line stanzas. Unlike the four-line stanzas that we looked at a little bit and we'll look at again, that Tennyson uses, that Fitzgerald uses, that are called rubaiyat stanzas, and we will look at those again. Three-line stanzas that interlock. So just do the rhyme scheme by letter. Start with thrace, were, race. So what letters do you give those?
A, B, A.
Okay. And then what happens to the B? There, bear are rhyming with were. Would have been better rhymes for Browning, but we still accept that as a rhyme. So the B rhymes do what? Yeah, so in the next stanza, so you have A, B, A, B, C, B, and then in the third stanza,
C, CDC.
CDC, right. And the fourth stanza, we'll stop after that.
DED.
DED, etc. So the middle stanza of each tercet does not rhyme in the tercet, but it gives you the two lines, not the middle stanza, I'm sorry, the middle line in each tercet doesn't rhyme in that tercet, but it gives you the outer lines of the next tercet and how they rhyme. So it's A, B, A, and then the B becomes B, C, B, the C becomes C, D, C, etc. Right? Everyone sees that? Anyone know what this rhyme scheme is called? Okay, it's an important rhyme scheme to know. It's called Terza Rima, and it the most famous poem written in Terza Rima is the Divine Comedy. So it's a rhyme scheme invented by Dante for the Divine Comedy, and the entire Divine Comedy is written in this rhyme scheme. It's somewhat easier to do in Italian than in English. It's a pretty hard thing to sustain. For one thing, you can only use words that have triple rhymes. Lots of words in English have double rhymes. South and mouth would be an example, but there's no other rhyme for south and mouth. But triple rhymes really restrict the number of rhymes you can do. But the effect of terza rima is that it's like a slinky going downstairs. That is, every stanza is pushing to the next stanza because every stanza has an unrhymed line in it that will only be rhymed if you write another stanza. So it's like the propagation of a crystal is another way of describing it. That is, that every tercet is complete with its second rhyme, A, B, A, but there's this hanging B, which then projects another stanza. So it's really hard to end a terza rima sequence. There are various things that poets do it, but by its nature, it's very hard to end a terza rima sequence. Probably the greatest writer in terza rima in English was Shelley. And his amazing last poem, The Triumph of Life, which is a very Dantesque poem and which Browning seems to have been obsessed with, is written in terza rima. His famous Ode to the West Wind is in terza rima sonnets. That is, what you have are four terza rima stanzas, first 12 lines, and then a couplet, because sonnets can end in couplets, a couplet which skips the middle line. So it's A, B, A, B, C, B, C, D, C, E, F, E, F, F. That's how the Ode to the West Wind works. But there's always something propulsive about terza rima. It's always a really active, pressing form. And Browning does it really well. Not too many poets in English do. Not too many poets in English try it. If you know Yeats's Cahooling Comforted, we'll do some Yeats, but not late Yeats. That's his last poem. That's written in terza rima. But it's a hard form. So that's just something to notice. So Thamyris Marching, Lyre, and Song of Thrace. What's a lyre?
Instrument.
Yes, an instrument. So he is the song and the instrument of Thrace, which is basically where Romania and Hungary are. That's where he was from. And then tells his story. Perpend the first, the worst of woes that were allotted lyre and song, ye poet race. Let's talk about this terrible thing that happened. Thamyris from Ocalia, feasted there by kingly Eurytos of late. So recently he was feasted there, now bound for Dorian at the uprise. So notice that Dorian in the Iliad is famed for Thamyris' disgrace. Now bound for Dorian at the uprise, broad and bare of Mount Pangaeos. So that's where it's going to happen. Or with earth enwound, glittered beneath his footstep. So there's gold underfoot. Or with earth enwound. Thamyris, marching gay and glad, Thessalia through, came, robed and crowned, from triumph on to triumph. So he's winning every poet contest. And the word triumph there might be a reference to the triumph of life. From triumph onto triumph, mid a ray of early morn, came, saw, and knew the spot where he was going to compete with the muses, signed him for his worst of woes that day. Okay, Quinn, you want to pick up from there?
Valera, happier while its name was not, met him not, but no wise menace slipped aside, obsequious river to pursue its lot of solacing the valley, save some wide, thick, busy human cluster, house and home, embanked for peace or thrift that thanks the tide.
Okay, great, thank you. So, he crosses the river, Balura River, making people able to live, solacing the valley, peace and thrift, but Thamyris keeps going. Leon?
Thamyris marching glad, each flake of foam, a sparkling ripple racing by, mocks slower clouds adrift in the blue dome. For autumn was the season, red the sky, held morn's conclusive signet of the sun to break the mist up, bid them blaze and die. Morn had the mastery as, one by one, all pomps produced themselves along the tract from earth's far ending to near heaven begun.
Okay, great. So, scene setting, it's autumn, it's the sky is red, it's a bright day. The mists are blazing and dying. They're being burned off. It's just a spectacular day for this contest. Julia, can you pick up from there?
Was there a ravaged tree? It laughed compact with gold, a leaf bald crisp, high brandished now, tempting to onset frost which late attacked. Was there a wizened shrub, a starveling bough, a fleecy thistle filched from by the wind, a weed Pan's trampling hoof would disallow? Each with a glory and a rapture twined about it, joined the rush of air and light and force. The world was of one joyous mind.
Great. So it's a gorgeous day for this contest. Frost is being tempted by the tree with golden leaves, but the tree is defying the frost that the golden leaves that it's showing are also predicting. Everything has a glory and a rapture twined about it, and there's this rush of air and light and force. The world was of one joyous mind. So let's go around again, Helene.
Say not the birds flew. They forbore their right, swam, reveling onward in the roll of things. Say not the beasts mirth bounded. That was flight. How could the creatures leap, no lift of wings? Such earth's community of purpose, such the ease of earth's fulfilled imaginings. So did the near and far appear to touch,
in
the moment's transport, that an interchange of function far with near seemed scarce too much.
Okay, so I'll relieve you here. Thank you. So it's just a spectacular time. No, birds weren't flying. They were swimming onward in the roll of things. The beasts were not bounding. They were flying. All of Earth was celebrating such Earth's community of purpose, such the ease of Earth's fulfilled imaginings. Earth itself has an imagination. That imagining is fulfilled in this just spectacular day. near and far appear to touch in the moment's transport. An interchange of function far with near seems scarce too much. Far and near come together. That could be a metaphor for rhyme schemes or for just, it's an ecstatic day, this day of this contest between Thamyris and the Muses. Sophia, you want to pick up there?
And had the rooted plant aspired to range, but the snake's license, while the insect yearned to grow fixed as the flower, it were not strange. No more than if the fluttery treetop turned to actual music, sang itself aloft, or if the wind, impassioned chantress, earned the right to soar in body in some soft, fine form, all fit for cloud companionship, and blissful, once touched beauty chased so oft.
Great, thank you. So, had the rooted plant aspired to range with the snake's license, if the plant wanted to do what? So the beasts aren't bounding, they're flying. The birds aren't flying, they're swimming. So all these natural objects are doing what? Yeah, it's this interchange. Yeah, it's the, well, or maybe it's not unnatural, but ecstatically totalizing. So if you say the beast bounded, you're not seeing just how everything, how there's an interchange of energy and possibility and ecstasy everywhere. The word interchange is the crucial one here. So, there is an interchange of function far with near, but an interchange of what things do. So the rooted plant, had it aspired to range, that wouldn't have been strange. So how would a plant range? What does range mean there?
It's growing and spreading.
Spread. Not spreading the way dandelions spread, but if it had unrooted itself and started crawling like a snake and had the rooted plant aspired to range with the snake's license. So just as the snake goes slithering over the ground, even the rooted plant might have done that. And what does the insect do? Or maybe the insect might have wanted to do what?
Grow fixed.
Yeah, like a flower. So then you could look at this beautiful insect that is growing like a flower. So if it wanted to grow fixed as a flower, we're not strange. No more strange than if the fluttery treetop turned to actual music, sung itself aloft. So the wind in the trees would turn into... into a song, not metaphorically, but really, sung itself aloft, would sing itself into growth. Or, no more strange than if the wind, impassioned chantress, what's a chantress?
Almost like a witch kind of figure. Right?
No, that's enchantress.
She's just a singer.
Yeah. So if the wind, impassioned chantress, earned the right to soar embodied in some soft, fine form, all fit for cloud companionship. So if the wind had turned into something with a body, fit for cloud companionship, what does that mean? What would it mean to be fit for companionship, let's just say? Leave the cloud out for a second.
Worthy to be.
Yeah, or physically capable to be a companion. Physically capable of being a lover. So a lover of what? Fit for cloud companionship. So if the wind, impassioned chantress, because winds do sing, we hear them howling, we hear the winds, they sing through the trees, through the leaves of the trees. But now, the fluttery treetop might turn to actual music, sing itself aloft, and the wind, which does sing, might become embodied it would, might have earned the right to soar embodied in some soft, fine form, all fit for cloud companionship. So companionship with what? What would the wind be in love with? With the clouds, yeah. And blissful, once touch beauty chased so oft. So the wind is in love with the clouds. And winds are always chasing clouds, but clouds are always escaping the wind. Why? Because they're being blown away. Unlike Russian balloons, let's say. I mean Chinese balloons, let's say. So, all fit for cloud companionship. And blissful, it's that kind of day. Everything is turning into everything. Each thing is turning into everything, you could say. And blissful, once touched beauty, chased so oft. Sam, you want to pick up there?
Famous marching, let no fancy slit born of the fiery transport. Lyre and song for his, to smite with hand and launch from lip. Fearless recorded since the list grew long of poets, sat hammerous.
Homerus.
Free to stand pedestal amid the muses' temple throng. A statue service, laurel, lyre in hand. I, for we see them, famous of the reign of grace, predominating foremost of the band.
Okay, great. So Thamyris marching, there we are at the beginning of the poem again, right? Let no fancy slip, born of the fiery transport. So he's transported. And every thought that he has, he keeps. All these things that Browning has just described, or that Sophocles has just described, Thamyris is noticing them all. Lyre and song were his. To smite with hand and launch from lip. So what do you smite with your hand? Which of the two, lyre or song?
Lyre.
Yes, and what do you launch from the lip?
Song.
Good, yeah, okay. Peerless recorded. So no one has been recorded as great a poet as Thamyris. Peerless recorded. Peerless is a really interesting word from Antony and Cleopatra. It is, Antony demands that the world should know we stand up peerless, he says, he and Cleopatra. So peerless recorded, since the list grew long of poets, saith Homeros, free to stand pedestaled mid the muses' temple throng. So Homer lists all these poets and says, Thamyris was the greatest of them all, peerless. Even Homer says there's a long list of poets. Thamyris was peerless, free to stand pedestaled mid the muses' temple throng. So in a temple to the muses, you would find statues of what? Again? Of Thamyris, yeah, and of other poets. So in the Muses' Temple, one way that you would see it is that you would see all the poets they inspired. He was free to stand pedestaled mid the Muses' Temple throng. A statued service, laureled, lyre in hand. We see them, Thamyris of Thrace predominating foremost of the band. So all these poets would be in the Temple of the Muses. A statued service, what does that mean? What's the word that Thamyris might not like?
Service.
Service, yeah. All these poets who are servants of the Muses. So he's a great poet, foremost of the band. Hang on to that phrase, by the way, the band, because we're going to get to it in the next poem that we look at. But foremost of the band. He could be there. He was free to stand, to predominate among all the other human poets. Thamyris of Thrace, predominating foremost of the band. Matthew, you want to go up for there?
Sure. Therefore, the born ray that enriched his face, if
it gave lambent chill to flame again from flush pride he saw he knew the place. What wind arrived with all the rhythms from plain, hill, dale, and that rough wild wood interspersed, compounding these to one constant strain. It reached him, music, but his own outburst of victory concluded the account, and that grew song which was mere music erst.
Great. So he is so sure of himself that even if the morn ray that enriched his face, if it gave lambent chill because it's autumn, it took flame again. It nevertheless burst into fire from flush of pride. So he is proud of his own powers. He saw, he knew the place. Hang on to that phrase. So the two phrases to hang on to are that he is foremost of the band and that he saw, he knew the place. Really remember that phrase because it's going to come back in the other poem we're going to start looking at today. What wind arrived with all the rhythms from plain hill, dale, and that rough wildwood interspersed. So there's wind coming from everywhere. The wind that was chasing the clouds, the wind that's singing through the trees. What wind arrived? Compounding these to one consummate strain, it reached him, music. So the wind from everywhere came to him as music, but what does he do? But his own outburst of victory concluded the account, and that grew song, which was mere music erst. Anyone know the Frost poem, The Aim Was Song? It's barely possible that Frost was thinking of this. It begins, before man came to blow it right, the wind blew itself untaught. And eventually humans have to teach the wind to be song. It's a sonnet. The last lines of the poem are, the aim was song, the wind could see. So the wind could see that the aim was song, that humans turn wind into song. Frost is always ironic, and the irony there is a difficult one. But I just want to point out that he may have been thinking of this moment. So that grew song, which was mere music erst. And Arena, can you just finish it now?
Be my Paranus?
Parnassus.
Parnassus? Though,
yeah, you're getting all the hard words. I'm sorry
yeah.
about that.
Okay. And turn the river nameless hitherto. Fame shalt thou vie with fame, Pyrrhus bound. Here I await the end of this ado, which wins earth's poet or the heavenly muse.
And, yeah.
Song broke up and mopped it.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So there he is, ready. Earth's poet is ready to take on the heavenly muse. And he says of this mountain, be my Parnassus. Parnassus is the haunt of the muses. River, you will now have a name. We already know that the river was happier before it had a name. You will vie, you will compete with a fount of inspiration. So this is a poem. So Browning is very old as he writes this poem, but it's a poem, you could say, of earliness, of being ready to, even though it's autumn, it's dawn, and it's an explosion into song where he plans to defeat the muses. We already know from Homer what happens to him. Sophocles in the play will have described what happens to him, which is he's blinded, like what other famous Greek poet whose name I just mentioned? Homer. And he has his memory destroyed. So he goes against the muses and he loses. Sorry for the rhyme there. If only one refuse or make sure that one refuses any contest where you go against the muses, because otherwise one loses. All right. Okay, good. But this is about, you could say, the dawn of inspiration. Inspiration doesn't work. You turn into someone who should have been reading Aristotle all your life. You turn into someone who gets destroyed by life, gets destroyed by the muses. Poetry doesn't save you. Unless there is a way to write a spectacular poem about how poetry doesn't save you. That might be the only possibility. So that a poem like Development and a poem like The Amorous Marching is a poem about still being loyal to an inspiration that you've now lived long enough to see doesn't get you anywhere except to seeing how amazing it would be to still be loyal to it, even then. So that's something that you'll see Browning doing over and over again. Someone wanted to do My Last Duchess, which is one of Browning's most famous poems. We should do it. I'm trying to think. What we really need to do, I mean, we need to do like all of it. If you're looking for a paper topic, Caliban upon Setebos might be one, especially if you know The Tempest at all. I'll just tell you briefly, Caliban upon Setebos is Caliban from The Tempest, is Prospero's, has to do everything and is mistreated by Prospero, but of course he's also not a particularly appealing figure in the play. And we're torn between what we think of him versus what we think of Prospero. His mother was someone named Sycorax in the play, in The Tempest. Do people, you're nodding, you remember this?
Yeah.
So Sycorax is his mother, and she worships a god whose name is Setebos. And that there's just a line in The Tempest about that, a single line, where Caliban says, he might even defeat my dam's god, Setebos. That is my mother's god, Setebos. And so Browning's poem, Caliban upon Setebos, it's also called, and this is another example of old versus new, it's called Natural Theology in the Island. That's its alternate title, Caliban upon Setebos, or Natural Theology in the Island. Natural theology is essentially rational theology. That is, look at the world, look how old it is, look at all the things that are happening. It couldn't have happened all by itself. There must be a God. What can we figure out about God? Let's look at nature. So it is a kind of belief in God, but you're trying to figure out what you can about God through quasi-scientific means, through looking at the world that science has helped us see. So Caliban is thinking about what Setebos must be like based on this island that he lives on and is kind of miserable on. And the poem is set just before Prospero and Miranda show up. So it's Caliban before the tempest begins. They show up at the end of the poem. So that's a context. We won't have a chance to look at it. One way or another, we'll look at My Last Duchess, which is very famous. But let us now take a look at the poem called Child Roland to the Dark Tower King, which is page, it's poem 118, page 137. And it is quite an amazing poem. It's just over 200 lines long. If you're looking for something to memorize, you'll be happy all your life if you memorize this poem. You really will. And the first thing to notice, actually, take a look at, I don't know, look at the previous poem, A Toccata of Galuppi's, which is also a great poem. I think all the Browning in this selection, there's a lot of really hard to get through Browning, but I think all the Browning in Rix's selection is great. What do you notice about the difference between the title of A Toccata of Galuppi's and Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came? Yeah, that, yeah, say more.
Oh, I don't, but like Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came is enclosed in that.
Yeah.
Whereas the Toccata isn't.
Yeah, so it's a title in quotation marks. And the quotation marks are part of the title. Generally, if you talk about Browning's Caliban upon Setebos or A Toccata of Galuppi's, you would say, in Browning's Caliban upon Setebos, the titular character copes with the same horrors of human life that Tennyson is describing in, quote, In Memoriam, unquote, when he talks about nature, quote, nature red tooth and claw, unquote. So if you were citing a title, you either italicize it or put in quotation marks. You all know this. Apparently, people don't know that shorter works should be in quotation marks and longer works should be in italics. So that's just a little tip for you. So if you are citing the title of a poem that's not a book-length poem like Aurora Leigh, but a poem that you would find in an anthology like Caliban upon Setebos, you put in quotation marks. If you were to cite Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came, in Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came, Browning considers the nothingness of human life, then you would have to put two quotation marks around those words because you are citing a poem whose title contains quotation marks. So why does the title contain quotation marks? What does that tell you?
It's a reference.
It's a reference. It's a quotation. Yeah. And what's it a quotation from? Yeah, so, yeah, more, say louder.
I think this is when poor Tom is in the storm and he, like, just very briefly at the end says, like, and Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came, and that's, like, the end of his,
yeah,
I think, speech at that time.
Yeah.
And there's no context given as to what is going on.
Exactly. So there,
then it's ambiguous, so there's, like, elements of ambiguity, like, going on in the rest of the scene.
Yeah, so Edgar, who is pretending to be mad and might be mad, that would be an argument about King Lear, but is certainly pretending to be mad. Like Hamlet, he's pretending to be mad and he might be what he's pretending to be. At one point is just going on and on in a really intense scene. And one of the things that he's doing is chanting these mad phrases. And at one point, at the end of the scene, he says, just out of nowhere, Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came. He then says another thing after that. That's not the very last thing he says. But there's this amazing line, Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came. And if you get a complete Shakespeare and you look it up, the best the footnotes will say is something like, presumably from a now lost ballad. But, you know, maybe not. But here's this incredible line out of context. And you read a line like that, Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came. If you're Stephen King, you write like a 7-volume fantasy series on the basis of that, which is actually on the basis of Browning. He read Browning's poem and was blown away by it. He says this in the intro to The Wasteland, which is the first volume. Have you read any of it?
My father really wants me to. I've, like, listened to it with him on audio.
Yeah.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, so there's a preface to the first volume when it was reissued where he talks about how he read this poem and it just totally stunned him, Browning's poem. But what Browning did, you can see, is that he read King Lear and this line totally stunned him. So here he is. So just the scene to set here. And here's an interesting fact also, that it was, he wrote this in 1853. Ricks doesn't tell you. Might have been 1854. His New Year's resolution that year was to write a poem a day, which he kept up for like 3 weeks. And this is one of the poems that he wrote one day. So he sat down and wrote this poem in a single day. What you can feel is that here's this amazing line, Child Roland to the Dark Tower came. And if you feel that the line is amazing, and you should, if you feel that that line is amazing, you might have two contradictory reactions to the line. You might want to find out where it's from, like any good epigraph in a novel that you're reading. You'll just read a great quotation at the beginning of a chapter, and you'll want to say, where is that from? Or you'll read a T.S. Eliot poem, because he's always quoting great lines out of context, and you'll say, where is that from? And part of you will know that if you look it up, it's not going to be as good. That is, once you know the context for a line like Child Roland to the Dark Tower came, you might find out that the Dark Tower is the name of a department store in Chicago, and that Child Roland was supposed to meet his sister-in-law at the Sears Tower, but no, he blew it, so Child Roland to the Dark Tower came, too bad. And then you'll say, damn, that's not what I wanted that line to mean. I wanted it, it's just so suggestive and so powerful that I should never have looked it up. Just the way, I mean, we've all had this experience with song lyrics. Great line in a song. You just love the line. You got a genius. The line turns out, A, not to be the way you heard it, you misheard it, and B, in context, it's really meh. So you've all had that experience? Kind of, yeah. So it's a risk when you see a great line like Child Roland to the Dark Tower came. Now, if you're Browning and you know the line is, you can't look up where it's from, what you might want to do, same thing as Stephen King, is you might now want to write a poem that the line could be from. And you want that poem not to spoil the line. But what are the odds that you're going to be able to write a poem that doesn't spoil the rhyme, doesn't spoil the line? Again, just think of great lines that you've seen and how you might, you imagine, you fantasize context for them. But any specific context that you fantasize is not going to be as good as the line. Or if any of you are writers, you probably have had the experience of coming up with the last line, let's say of your story first. It's like, here's a great line. Now I got to get to it. And that's really hard. You may have a really great last line, but then what? How do you get there without spoiling it? So that is a literary experience. And what it says is something about the nature, you could say, of literary inspiration, which is something strikes you. This great line strikes you. And then the work after that moment of inspiration is to try to produce a work, a piece of writing, which is as good as the inspiration. And that's really hard. And most people feel that they fail at it. So here's Browning. And here's this amazing line. And what he decides to do is to write a poem which gives a context for that line. But the very first thing that he has to deal with is that that's going to be a really hard thing to do, to write something worthy of a line that's as great as that. That's going to be really, really hard. So in a sense, what the poem does, we'll start talking about this on Wednesday, is it goes meta on that issue, which is that he wants to write a poem which is good enough for that line, which then becomes a quest for him. The quest is to produce a poem which is good enough for that line. Everyone know what a child is with an E at the end? Anyone know what a child is with an E at the end?
Yeah, I mean, it's more like a way to just address young men from well-off families at the time, like, you know, Child Harold.
Yeah, so it's definitely, he's thinking of Child Harold. But what it means is someone who is trying to become a knight. So a child is a candidate for knighthood.
Oh.
So what it means essentially is a young person in quest of, on an adventure in quest of an achievement that would earn them knighthood. And it's not, oh yeah, little kid Roland to the Dark Tower came. It means young aspirant for knighthood. And that kind of aspiration here you could compare to Thamyris's. Thamyris's aspiration is to be the greatest poet of all time. Roland's aspiration, as you will see, is to achieve a quest that a knight is after. That is, that the poem belongs to a genre called quest romance, where quest romance means it's a story about a quest for something impossible or almost impossible to find. The Holy Grail being, don't think Monty Python, just get it out of your head, but the Holy Grail being one of the great objects of the quest. So in this poem, reread it for Wednesday, but in this poem, the object of the quest is, for Roland, it's the Dark Tower. For Browning, it's the line, Child Roland to the Dark Tower came. It's not, oh, what is that line? I forget. Oh, I'm going to have to Google it. Oh, there it is. I've succeeded in finding the object of my quest as Child Roland to the Dark Tower came. No, it's a context for that line. It's making that line what it should be, which is what you might imagine it is without being able to imagine it, except that it's such a great line. So you get a vision of a great line the way in quest you get a vision of the thing that you're searching for. And now you address your steps, to use Browning's phrase, to finding that line, to finding the Dark Tower, and not screwing it up, not having the Dark Tower turn out to be some disappointing thing once you have it in context. That's why Stephen King had to write all those volumes, because he couldn't get there, because getting there without screwing it up is really, really hard, and that's what Browning is trying to do. So guess quickly, if you don't remember, what the last line of the poem is. Object of the quest.
Child Roland to the Dark Tower came.
Yeah, that's the last line of the poem. Okay, we will talk about it on Wednesday. See you then.